contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And I've had fun all week flying my quadcopter.
I'll bet you have.
Yeah, it's been a great time. I was out flying in the snow and had a lot of fun with that all week. And, of course, a lot of nice things happening in technology, as always. They're now mapping, using Twitter feeds, happiness.
What?
They're mapping happiness state by state, city by city, zip code by zip code. You can look it up and get the happiness index of your city on a daily basis.
Is this based on the content of Twitter?
Of Twitter, that's right.
So people are happy or not?
So whether their people are happy or whether they're not happy. So, you know, so at the, you know, at the time that I did this, looked it up, it turned out that Hawaii was the happiest state.
I wonder why that is.
And Louisiana was the saddest. So it's kind of interesting thing here. Now, the Napa is the happiest city in the country, and I'll get more into all that detail later in the show. I kind of enjoyed that.
Yes.
That particular thing. Also, did you remember NORAD was tracking Santa Claus?
Yes. Does
See,
it
that
every
was
year,
extremely
right?
important to me because Santa Claus brought my drone. So I was tracking Santa all the way, and it's an interesting story. They've been tracking Santa since 1955,
mm-hmm.
and it was all because of an error in a phone number where somebody called NORAD by mistake, and a tradition started.
Huh.
So I'll go back through the story on how that got started back in 1955.
That I did not know.
Because, you know, I really enjoyed tracking Santa this year because I wanted to find out when my drone was going to arrive. And today we're going to feature Tony Fadell. He, of course, is the father of the Apple iPod.
Mm-hmm.
But I featured him earlier just for the iPod. But now he's also the father of the Nest thermostat, which is the Wi-Fi thermostat that learns.
We were talking about something like this as one of the Christmas gifts.
Yeah, we've talked about that. And now they have a Nest. They also have a smoke detector. It's all Wi-Fi enabled.
Mm-hmm.
I like this Wi-Fi stuff, Jim, because this is sort of what I like to play around with. I have 50 wireless light bulbs in the house that I can control with my cell phone.
I'm actually sort of getting into this because the whole Wi-Fi thing lets you do so much stuff wirelessly. It's
great. And then I punched a couple of holes in my firewall so I can control my lights remotely. So when I'm in India, I can turn the lights on and off, which is always and I can also control my TV remotely with Wi-Fi.
So it creates
opportunities for mischief.
We need to have this discussion about TVs because my dog keeps eating our remotes.
Yeah.
And there's got to be a way that I can do everything off my iPhone, right? Isn't there?
I just use my iPhone, and I download the app to my iPad. So now we have two iPads, two iPhones. We don't even use remotes.
I'm going to have to figure this out because I'm tired of buying new remotes because the dog decided he wanted to use it as a bone.
Yeah, so maybe I could have a feature on that.
I need help.
I could have a feature on that, and that would be kind of an interesting deal.
Mm-hmm.
One story that I didn't get to last week, they're now going to block the activation of stolen smartphones. I'll get into that and why that's such a good thing. And, of course, it was a huge mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Here we go. See how big that was?
There were a few people who weren't sending you stuff over the holidays, frankly.
Yeah,
but
I know.
It's okay.
Everybody waiting for Santa Claus,
mm-hmm.
tracking NORAD. We got an email from Carl Tyler. Dear Dr. Schertz, I have a suggestion for Tech Talk Radio's profiles in IT. His name is Emmanuel Derman. He was originally a particle physicist. See, he knows I like physicists.
There you go.
See, I'm really partial to physicists. Then he went on to work for AT&T Labs. And then he was hired by Solomon Brothers and Goldman Sachs to use his math skills in quantitative analysis. and people that use math skills on Wall Street for quantitative analysis are called quants.
Uh-huh.
So he was a quant, a Wall Street quant. Well, I'll check him out. That's a kind of an interesting thing. There's a lot of physicists that actually went to Wall Street to apply some of the mathematics of physics to predictions.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good suggestion. I'll look at that. Thank you for that email. We love suggestions for Tech Talk. We got an email from Azra in Fredericksburg. Dear Tech Talk, I would like to create an album of my recent trip. I have Windows 7 laptop. What are my options? Love the show, Azra. Well, the days of the manual scrapbook are gone.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I mean,
right.
You know, it used to be you'd paste it in, you'd write on them. You know, that's just gone. And now we've moved to the digital age. So I think the question is, how can she create a digital scrapbook that she could share?
Mm-hmm.
And she has a Windows machine. So, I mean, one option that's right out that's quite easy would be Microsoft Publisher. And you can, they have albums in that. Now Publisher is really not really made to interface with printers that well. You can do it. It's a somewhat clunky interface, but it's free if you've got Office. They've got limited templates. But it works. And so if you just want something quick and dirty, I just use a Microsoft Publisher. Now, if you want to do something that would be a little bit easier, there are other options. Now, there are many companies that give you free photo album software. It's all web-based, and you create your photo album, but they don't let you print it. They don't let you share it. The only option is to print it with their printer at their printing price. So you're kind of locked in. So I don't really like that kind of option. So I'll give you a couple that I like that are quite nice. One is My Memory Suite. That's $39. You download that, and you can create your and they've got a lot of templates. It's a nice way to create albums. You can print it yourself. You can export it to a file and send it to any printer. You can let them print it, but you can also upload it to their servers, and people can look at it as an album right online. So that's quite a nice one. My Memory Suite, but it only supports PCs. $39.97. I wonder how they came up with 97. Must some kind of somewhat of a marketing analysis.
Yeah, it doesn't.
$39.97 is
like
just a little
$40.
Cheaper than $39.99. They said, "Yeah, let's give it." So then the second one that was quite nice is Memory Mixer, and that works for either the PC or the Mac. That's $29.95. Memory Mixer allows you to embed both sound files and videos. See, one of the problems is people take all these videos with their iPhone, but a video won't fit in a photo album.
Right.
Well, you can embed the video into your Memory Mixer album, so people click on the video.
That's a great idea.
And you get it. So that's not a bad idea. So those would be two options, and both of them allow you to either print it yourself or let the folks print it there, and they've got some pretty good options for printing. You can get a reasonable album for, you know, maybe $40, and then additional pages are either 50 cents a page or $1 a page, depending on the page size. It was a great question and very apropos after the holidays, because people are now making lots of albums.
21st century photo albums, right?
We got an email from Jim in Michigan. Dear Doc and Jim, sometimes when I attempt to connect to my local coffee house's Wi-Fi, I can connect to a strong signal, but it says limited or no connectivity to the internet. Now, other people are just surfing away on the web, and there I am. I can't connect at all. Now, the shop owner, not willing to reset the router. That would be the normal thing, reset the router. Shop owner's not willing to reset the router because he says the router connects his credit card machine. If he resets it, he can't put through the credit cards for a while.
Sure.
Also, he says other people are on the router, doesn't want to interrupt their session, so he won't help me at all. Now, is there a setting on my laptop that might improve the situation? Now, I've tried rebooting my laptop. I've tried disabling the wireless, starting the wireless. Nothing helps. I'm using Windows 7 Pro. Thanks, Jim in Michigan. Well, my first recommendation is just what you did. Turn off your Wi-Fi and turn it back on again. You've already done that. In some cases, you can click on the network icon that represents the connection, and you can right-click on that, and then you can click disable, wait a minute, then click enable, or your laptop might have a little switch to turn off the Wi-Fi. Any of those would work. on other machines, you might do it another way. But you want to turn off the Wi-Fi, turn it back on again. Now, what limited connectivity means is that you've made a physical connection with the wireless, but it hasn't given you an IP address. So you see, the IP address, there's an internal IP address, and the way these routers work, they use a protocol called DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. And so as soon as you turn on to make the connection, your router or your computer says, hey, I need an IP address, and it makes a request to the router to give you an IP address. And if it doesn't receive one, it can't communicate to the internet. It's just sitting there without connection. Now, there are a couple of things that could be. It could be really an old router, and it just can't keep up with the traffic, so it's not getting around to giving you an IP address, which is a possibility. Now, the other option would be that maybe they have limited the number of connections that are allowed, and they might only allow 6 connections because it's very limited internet access, and so you're the 7th guy. And you can't get on, so you really don't know. You really don't know how to what the option is. And so your best bet then is just to try to keep trying until you can get an IP address assigned, or until somebody else drops off and you can pick up their slot.
Right.
Or the next option, go to a different coffee house.
Well, there's also
that would be my thing. But there's really nothing wrong with your computer.
No,
it's all with the router.
Now, and the other option, I guess, would be to have an air card or a wireless card, so that you wouldn't have to worry about that situation if you really needed to get something done.
That's right. Or you could use your phone as a hotspot.
Sure.
And so which if you have an Android phone, you can make your phone a hotspot. It doesn't cost you anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now the trouble with the iPhone, like I have Verizon, if I turn my iPhone to a hotspot, they charge me $10 a month.
Oh.
And it's my same data.
Right.
It's my same data limit. I should not have to pay for that, but they charge me for it. So the only way I could do it without paying $10 a month would be to hack my iPhone and install an unauthorized hotspot software, which I could do.
You could do that.
Which you have
the knowledge.
Which I could do. But of course, I would never do that because it would keep Verizon from getting their $10 a month.
Of course.
So I would not do that. But some people would do that.
The whole concept of using your iPhone or your Android as a hotspot, maybe that's something you'd talk about someday. That's kind of a neat idea.
Yeah, it actually works quite well. My sister traveled across the, she took a road trip with her. Two sisters took a road trip together, so one of them got the hotspot. So they were actually working on their laptop while they were in the car using the iPhone hotspot.
Hmm.
So it was actually quite a nice deal, because there are many, many areas in the country where maybe a hotel, maybe they were staying in hotels that didn't even have Wi-Fi, but they always had their hotspot. Okay, dear Tech Talk, I was recently told that I should scan my router for open ports. Open ports.
Hmm.
Now, what is an open port? How are they created? I look at my router. I don't see any open ports in it. It just looks like a box. How can we scan the router for open ports, and how do we close them? What's going on here? Alex in Reston. Well, let's talk about what is a port, first of all, and how is it used. So the protocol on the internet is TCP/IP, Transmission Control Protocol, Internet Protocol, and it's used by the internet to allow programs to communicate to each other. Now, every computer has programs inside of it, and the computer's address is called the IP address. But when a packet arrives at that address, the protocol stack has to know, well, which program am I going to send it to?
Mm-hmm.
And so every program has a number called a port number. So it arrives at the IP address, and then it's referred to a particular port number to a particular program. So the analogy I like to give, suppose it's a hotel. The street address is like the IP address, and the room number is the port number. So if you go to the hotel and don't know the room number, you'll never find the guest, because you have to know their port. So that's really what it is, and there are different standard ports that are used. Like, say, when you connect to a web server, it's always port 80. So web servers are always listening for port 80 requests, and so you communicate through port 80. All the web internet's port 80. If you do email, it's port 25. SMTP is port 25, or it could be port 110. if it's a POP protocol, or if you're doing file transfer protocol, it's port 21 or port 22. So your router is set up to allow these ports to pass through, and it because your router's been told that we might do file transfer protocol, we might do email, we might do web, so it's going to allow those ports to pass through. But there might be other ports that say go to some remote access, remote control of your laptop. So you would not want those ports to go through. So you only allow ports that go through the router that you're listening for, and any other ports you would want to not listen for or block. So that's really what. And so an open port would be a port which is open, which you don't want, don't know about, and don't use. Now you can scan your router for open ports.
Hmm.
You ever done that?
No.
Called Shields Up. You go to Gibson Research Center, grc.com, click Shields Up, and it will scan your router and give you an open port report.
Huh.
And then you can actually, if you've got a bunch of ports that are open, you can actually log on to your router web interface, and you can close the ports in your router interface. I think this is really not a big problem for most people, but it gave me just a chance to talk a little bit about how the internet works, and of course, I always love to do that. We got an email from Steve. Dear Tech Talk, I recently received a laptop from my employer. Congratulations, Steve. He must have gotten a promotion or something. I work on some sensitive data, and will be carrying my laptop around with me on travel. What precautions should I take in the event my laptop is lost or stolen? Love the show, Steve. Well, that's a man who prepares for the worst.
Uh-huh.
And that's very good.
So, that's good thinking.
So there, two words sum it up, Steve. Backup and encryption.
Yes.
Those are the two words. Now, see, the backup will prepare you for a hard disk failure or for a lost machine. Now, you can back it up on your company's servers, and many times they'll set up a VPN to do that where your laptop will attach via VPN to your company's servers. It will back up automatically. And when you're on site at your company's on the local area network, it'll just back up through the LAN. You could set up your home. You could set up a home server to do that. Now, actually, what I do, I just signed up for Carbonite. I've got Carbonite, $59 a year. My laptop is backed up continuously. I make a change, it's backed up. I go to India, it's backed up, and wherever I go, my laptop is backed up. So if I'd ever lose my laptop or it would be stolen, at least I could get the data. Now, the problem is, suppose you've got a database there with a bunch of social security numbers on it and passwords, things that would really be bad news if it were published or sold to hackers.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. So in the case of your data being stolen and used improperly, you really need to encrypt it. You need to encrypt the data on the hard drive. And you can encrypt your data with, there is a program that encrypts file by file called TrueCrypt. It's a very good tool, TrueCrypt, TrueCrypt. And each time that you encrypt a file, it creates what looks like a virtual drive.
Mm-hmm.
And when you mount that drive, which means you're attaching that file, it asks for the password. You put in the password, it unencrypts it, and all the data's there. So every time that you have to access this sensitive data, you have to mount the data by putting in the password. Of course, if somebody steals your hard drive, they're not going to get the data because it's encrypted. Now, I would not trust – you can do encryption within Microsoft Office, for instance, like Word, Excel, or other tools like WinZip. But these sort of application-level encryptions are fairly easy to crack, and I wouldn't recommend it. So I'd recommend you do TrueCrypt. Now, if you want to encrypt your entire hard drive, then what you would do is when your computer is booting up, before it can access the hard drive, it's going to ask you for a password, and you'll have to put in a password before it will even boot up. That would be if you wanted to encrypt everything. I think probably just encrypting your sensitive data is another. It would be good enough. Now, there's another issue a couple of other issues I could mention. If somebody would steal your computer, maybe you don't have any sensitive data, but in your browser cache, you might have passwords. Or you might have been logged on to something. So they may be able to get passwords to your accounts. That's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to protect yourself from that is to have what they call two-factor authentication, where when you log on, it's going to send you an email, and you'll have to do something else. It'll send you an email with a number, and then you have to put that number in. And unless you have access to this other email account, it's not going to work. You could have two-factor authentication where it would send a code to your cell phone. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have to put that code from your cell phone in, and you could only do the two-factor authentication if you had the password, plus you had access to the device where they were sending out this this additional code message. And so so even if they did get your password, they wouldn't they would not be able to do the two-factor authentication, so they couldn't log on. So if you got if you really want to protect yourself, you'd want to have all your all of your key accounts so that they support two-factor authentication. Google was one of the earliest adopters of this, and many bank accounts do that too. Now, if you're worried about mobile devices, we'll get the last thing. Of course, you got a mobile device. That's fairly hard to secure. It's not as easy to do all those that encryption as they did there. But what you can do if you have a mobile device, you can use either Apple via the iCloud, Find My Phone, or you've got through Android's Google Android Device Manager, you can actually locate your phone and you can wipe the data. So if the phone is stolen, you can wipe all the data off of it. So like with, if my iPhone would get stolen, I'd be able to log on and wipe all the data off of it, and they wouldn't have access to it. So that's kind of the way you could protect your mobile device. It's a good question, and those are very good practices to follow if you're worried about security. We love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu. We'll talk about them on the show, and I might even respond to them personally on occasion. on rare occasion.
On rare occasion. There you go. Well, this is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. Profiles in IT is next. This is Tech Talk on Federal News Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
It's time. Time to put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge. It's time. Time to take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. Or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, it's time to be more.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Yep.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for...
Profiles in IT.
See, this is why I'm here.
It's good that there's because a professional in the studio.
He gets distracted so easily.
I know. I was playing with my drone.
Fire that thing up just a second.
Yeah. Okay. Want me to
fire it up.
Okay.
Just
here we go.
So you guys heard Doc talk back before the holidays that he was buying a drone, and now he's got it. We're working on some special programming for you involving the drone.
Yes, and I put it over there near the chair where David Byrd usually sits, so he might get a haircut, but...
Yeah,
we'll see how this works out.
Uh-huh, exactly. Anyway, so more on the drone probably next week. We'll be talking about that.
Yes.
A multimedia production, as a matter of fact. Okay. Anyway, so we were
talking about Tony Fadell.
Uh-huh.
We're going to feature him in Profiles in IT. He, of course, is the father of the Apple iPod. Now, I'm still trying to find who the mother is. I just know who the father is.
Okay.
But he is the father of the Apple iPod and also of the Nest thermostat, which is a Wi-Fi enabled thermostat, which actually could be one of my next toys. So So as his mother called him, his mother didn't call him Anthony Fidel. She called him Anthony M. Fidel. That's when she was mad at him. He was born March 22nd, 1969. In Detroit, Michigan.
Yes.
Those were the better days for Detroit back in 69. Mm-hmm. He moved with his family throughout the country. He attended 11 schools, elementary schools. And as an eighth-year-old, he had his first job is selling eggs, kind of entrepreneurial at a young age. He attended the Grosse Pointe South High School at Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan. He received a Bachelor of Science in Computer Engineering in 1991 from the University of Michigan. And while at Michigan, he started his first company called Constructive Instruments, which marketed multimedia composition software for children. So he's already doing a little computer programming back then.
Mm-hmm.
That company didn't last too long, but he sort of was able to do a little innovation, and he had a lot of fun with that. In 1992, he started to work for an Apple spinoff called General Magic. Now, he started as a diagnostics engineer, and he progressed to systems engineer, and he developed the Magic Cap PDA platform, Personal Digital Assistant. It was sort of a precursor, really, to a smartphone. This is the PDA. This was back. That's how he got interested in all this iPhone stuff,
mm-hmm.
iPod stuff. Now, during his 3.5 years at General Magic, he had to refocus. He worked, day and night. He lost touch with his family. All his personal relationships got messed up. He gained 40 pounds, and he lost 50 pounds. He was like on a seesaw. So he decided, okay, I better move on. This is just taking too much time. So he got another job. That was the solution. He went to work for Philips. And Philips was just trying to get into the mobile computing business then. So he was co-founder and lead of the mobile computing group. This was a new start within Philips. And he wanted the team to act like a startup. That's what he wanted. He wanted the startup energy. So he got his own building. They painted the walls yellow and purple. They had open cubicles. And, of course, as a startup, free soda and free fruit. But his real passion was with these mobile devices. He discovered he loved mobile devices because you hardly had any space and you had to use real creativity to mm-hmm. sort of cram all that stuff in. And he felt that the constraints on space forced creativity. And so this was a challenge that he just loved doing. In 1990, he started his own company called Fuse.
Uh-huh.
Fuse. And one of the devices that he had on his mind was a small hard disk-based music player. This was back there. Well, people were trying to get portable music players. And he got the idea, let's do something with a small hard drive. And so he started developing that, and he was, he loved the idea. It was a small device, mobile device. It was his sweet spot. But, of course, it was his own company, and he got his first round of funding. But then he could not secure a second round of funding. And what happens then? You run out of cash.
Yeah, and you can't. So back in the 90s, people are walking around with probably a Sony Walkman.
Yeah.
And at that point, CD players weren't that really
would,
prevalent.
It could be a CD. It may have been a tape player.
Yeah, I mean, right.
But he had this dream of having a mobile music device.
Mm-hmm.
So when he failed to get his second round of funding, he started looking around for somebody who could, somebody he could go work for and let him continue to work on his dream. So he went to Real Networks first in 2000. Now, Real Networks was, they were trying to get into the audio business. It was a big opportunity for them. So he showed up in 2000. They hired him to work on this project. But the guy that he worked for was just a total jerk. He left in 6 weeks. Bingo. So then he approached Apple. I mean, in the iPod, remember, it was the turnaround device for Apple. So this was back when Apple was really hurting.
Mm-hmm.
Jobs had just come back. I mean, they were hurting. They really didn't have much market share. Their stock was down. And people said, what's the future of Apple? And so he showed up with this audio device. And Steve Jobs said, "Yeah, I like that." So he hired him. Now, he didn't trust him completely, so in the beginning, they only hired him as a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
In February 2001, they hired him as a contractor. And by April of 2001, that'd be February, March, April, in just a couple of months, they hired him full-time, and they wanted him to put together a team, and they wanted to run the iPod and the Special Projects Group. And so he oversaw the design and production of the iPod. And by October 23rd, 2001, look at the time on this. They hired him as a contractor in February 2001. He was full-time in April, and by October 2001, they released the iPod.
That's amazing.
Isn't that a fact? Look, so he was full. So he assembled the team in April. It's April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November. I mean, it's like eight or nine months.
Here we are on the technology show doing math on our fingers.
It's well. It's because, you know, it's because I'm a drone man now. I'm not a grown.
You're
I'm
making
not,
sure your fingers are
I'm
still
not a,
there.
I'm not a grown man. I'm a drone man.
A drone man.
So he in April 23rd they released the iPod. Now it had a code. See, all secret things in Silicon Valley have code names. It was codenamed Project Dulcimer. Project Dulcimer. And it was formally released November 10th. It was announced October 23rd, formally released November 10th. By 2004, he was promoted to vice president of iPod engineering. In March of 2006, he was promoted to senior vice president of the iPod division. And if you look at the iPods, they look like a precursor to the iPhone.
Yeah,
you know, I've got an old iPod. You know, it looks like an iPhone.
Looks like an iPhone 3, right?
Yeah, it looks like an iPhone, except there's just no phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, really, the operating system was developed on the iPod. And so he got in a big fight with the guy who was doing iPhone software development. Because the iPhone software guy was stealing all of his iPod people. Because you see, they were so common systems, so they were like in a big knockdown, drag-out battle. And by November 4th of 2008, Tony just got fed up with all the politics there at Apple, and he just left. He stepped down. And in November 2008, and he said, I don't want to put up the politics at Apple, but I'm going to be a personal advisor to Steve Jobs, because he and Steve got along.
Sure.
And so that's what he did. And then he had to sort of refocus his life. Well, he lived at Lake Tahoe, and he was building a high-efficiency home near Lake Tahoe, getting all this wireless stuff.
Kind of like you.
Home automation, all getting involved with all this stuff.
Remote-controlled light bulbs.
Yeah, and he got to the thermostat, and he realized that thermostat technology had really not changed. Have you ever tried to program your thermostat where you got to, you pick the weekend and the day, and you got all the time for? It's like trying to program a VCR.
Exactly.
And they were so complicated, and he thought, well, why can't we make a thermostat as simple to use as an iPod?
Right.
You know, why don't we use the Apple philosophy of simplicity? And why don't we create a thermostat that just sort of learns when you're there? It just observes you, and it, on its own, creates an energy-efficient profile just by observing your patterns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you don't have to program at all. So they made the Nest thermostat. There's just one button. There's nothing to program. You just use it. And you turn it up, turn it down, and it just remembers what you do. It tracks what you do. It can tell when there's no activity around it because it can monitor if people are walking around. And it knows when nobody's there, and it just controls your house in a very energy-efficient way. So it's a great idea. Now, it's $250, you know, so if you want to have cost-effective operation, you got to pay for it.
Exactly. But it'll pay for itself over time, I would
think.
It will
pay for itself. So he started Nest Computers. I mean, he was inspired by his Lake Tahoe. He actually co-founded Nest Computers with Matt Rogers, who was one of the iPod programmers. So they co-founded the Nest Labs in his garage in Palo Alto, California. And it designs, their mission was to design sensor-driven, Wi-Fi-enabled, a learning programmable thermostat. And now it's in its second generation. They've also come out with a smoke detector. And the smoke detector talks to your thermostat. And the smoke detector also detects
heat?
Detects carbon monoxide.
Oh.
So, like, for instance, if it detects there's way too much carbon monoxide, it might mean that your gas furnace is failing. So then it communicates to the thermostat to turn off the gas furnace.
Mm-hmm.
So they talk together. And the the smoke detector detects your presence in the room, and so the thermostat uses that information to tell when you're in the house to adjust the temperature. So the reason he sort of came up on my radar this week is because just this last week they secured $150 million of venture financing based on a $2 billion valuation for the company. So they started it back in 2010, May of 2010. Now it's valued at $2 billion. So Tony's kind of an innovative guy. I saw an interview that he gave. He said, you know, I don't want to just be remembered as father of the iPod. I want to be remembered as something bigger than that.
Sure.
So that's why he wants to do Nest and continue to invent. He's authored his more than 300 patents. And in 2012, he is a recipient of the Alva Award, honoring him as the next great serial inventor. So there you go. Tony Fadell, his first success, the iPod, and his second success is the Nest thermostat.
Well, pretty interesting stuff, and we hope you're paying attention, right, Doc? Because
yes.
You'll get your chance here in just a minute to win free stuff from us, namely food. So stay tuned for the pop quiz here on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, and online at techtalkonline.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Yes, you thought this was a radio show.
I give up.
Actually, it is not. It's a classroom of the airways. It's also a classroom of the internet because we're streaming live over the internet. And if you get the correct answer to the pop quiz, which, of course, is what we always have when we have a classroom of the airwaves,
yes,
you'll win two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room, and the Karam Dining Room. Earlier in the show, we were talking about Tony Fadell. Of course, he is the father of the iPod and also father of the Nest thermostat.
Mm-hmm.
While he was working on the iPod at Apple, it was a secret project under the highest security, and it had a code name. What is the code name for the iPod prior to its release?
Well,
it was Project Blank.
And if they get the answer correct, what do they win?
To get the answer, you get two tickets to fine dining at the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karam Dining Room.
Okay. And the way to get that answer to us, because it is just, it's not an hour-long radio program, but an hour-long classroom of the airwaves.
Yes.
Right. You got to call us on the phone, your POTS line. If you're calling from north of Detroit, Michigan, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from west of Palo Alto, California, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line for everybody else in the continental United States is 877-936-9333. 936-9333.
And if you're calling from the Himalayas, you can call using Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and your call will be forwarded to the studio free of charge.
Okay. So while we're waiting for the phones to ring, you're going to talk about something else.
Yes. Let's talk about Santa Claus and how that got started back in 1955. Christmas was approaching, and Sears had a great idea for a Yuletide gimmick, as they said. So in the local newspapers, they placed an ad, and they said, as though the ad was placed by Santa himself, and they said, "Hey, kiddies, call me on my private phone line, and I'll talk to you personally day or night." And, of course, they would have the kids all call Sears. So the ad listed all the local phone numbers for the kids to call all over the country. And they also placed an ad there in Colorado Springs, Colorado, but it turned out
Santa Claus music.
There it is.
Here comes Santa Claus.
Yeah.
I had to get Elvis. We got Santa Claus. Okay, continue on.
There's a Santa Claus. That's right. Brings back memories. So back in Colorado Springs, Colorado, they placed an ad in the paper, "Please call Santa Claus," and it was ME26681. But the problem is, that phone number was actually a typo. It was off by one digit. And the number that Sears actually had ended up printing and distributing to the citizens in Colorado Springs, Colorado, was for the Continental Air Defense Command, CONAD, which was the predecessor of NORAD. And suddenly, on Christmas Eve, phone calls intended for St. Nick were being received on the top-secret NORAD line, a line that was reserved for a Russian attack. So, Colonel Harry Shoup, officer in charge of CONAD, picked up the phone. "Yes, sir, this is Colonel Shoup." And he said, and it was just silence. And then he said, "Sir, this is Colonel Shoup." And there was more silence. "Sir?" Shoup, probably at this point, was not really very happy. He said, "Can you read me all right?" And finally, the caller spoke up. It was a little girl, and she said, "Are you really Santa Claus?" And Shoup, at that point, demanded to know who was calling.
Uh-huh.
He was brusque. He didn't make any sense. The little girl started crying, but she didn't give up. "Are you one of Santa's elves?"
Oh, my.
Shoup thought it must be a prank, and then all of a sudden it occurred to him that maybe...
I think the drone is
my drone
telling
is beeping
you
because mm-hmm. I left the remote on.
Okay.
And so finally, he said, "Maybe there's something wrong with the phone line." And so he said, "Maybe this is actually a mistake." So then he just flipped over. He says, "Why, yes, I'm one of Santa's elves." and he says, "Have you?" And then he said, "Oh, well, have you been a good little girl?" And then more calls started coming in. So Shoup went around and he grabbed anybody who was standing around. They were manning the phones. They said, "You're one thing. You just pretend you're Santa Claus." And that night they started tracking Santa Claus, and it became a tradition. Now, since that time in 1955, they've been doing it every year. And now there are countless numbers that are answered by Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps. In 2009, they handled more than 12,000 emails and more than 70,000 phone calls from 200 countries. In 2011, Michelle Obama actually entered on behalf of the North Pole NORAD as one of Santa's elves. So
that's
there you go.
Funny.
It all started as a typo.
Okay. It is time for us to give away our first free food of the year. Let's go to line two. This is Jim calling us from Vienna, Virginia. Good morning, Jim. How are you, sir?
Good morning. I'm doing fine. Happy 2014.
Same to you.
Well, thank you. So early in the show, I talked about Tony Fadell, father of the Apple iPod. What was the code name for the iPod program before it was officially announced?
That was Project Dulcimer.
That is correct. You win two tickets to fine dining to the Escoffier Dining Room, the Karim Dining Room. Just stay on the line and talk to Andrew, our able assistant.
That's right. He is the adjunct professor for prize distribution and crowd control is his official title. So, Jim, thanks for playing. Thanks for being our first winner of the year. Hang on just a second. You are indeed listening to Tech Talk Radio. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. We will be back with more Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. It's time. Time to put your talents out there on your terms and set your own pay. If you are ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management covers the skills to launch your business from writing a solid business plan to financing, branding, and marketing. Choose from our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge. Contact us today at stratford.edu. Stratford University. It's time to be more.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And I've been playing all week with my quadcopter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I got it a couple of weeks ago. And I've just been having a great time with it. It actually... Phantom Vision 2, it's got an integrated camera, it's got a 14 megapixel camera, it's got an f2.8 lens, and it has three fields of view, 140 degree, 120, or 90, and I can capture 1080p video or 720p video. I can do 14 megapixel pictures, and it's very easy to fly. It's like a camera platform. It's got GPS control, has a built-in compass, built-in altimeter, built-in gyroscope. And I simply set it to a position, altitude that I want, and it just stays there. Even if there's a breeze, it will just keep sailing into the breeze in order to stay at that position.
That's amazing.
So I've taken it up to like a 1,000 feet, and the highest I've been is 1,050 at a range away of around 400 feet down. When I went down 400 feet and up 1,080, I lost RF connection. But then when you lose RF connection, it just says, coming home, and it uses GPS, and it lands exactly where it took off from.
No,
automatically.
Kidding. But the rotors will keep spinning and everything.
They keep spinning, and it comes back until it gets directly above where it launched based on the GPS signal, and it starts lowering itself. It comes down to 40 feet and stops at 40 feet for a minute.
So it reestablishes connection?
No, to give you, in case it's on top of a car or a bush.
Okay.
So you can either, you know, because the GPS is only active about 20 feet. So
okay.
So it could come back, and you could take control.
It could land on somebody's head.
Yeah, you could take control of it there that way, or you could move the kids out of the way, and then it just lands. And so it's it's really, really nice. It was $1,200, which, you know.
Well, actually, yours was $1,230 because you had to buy two extra propellers, right?
Yeah. Actually, I've already broken five propellers. I had the grandkids over. My grandson put it on the roof. That was a two propeller accident.
Now, does it come with any extra propellers, or did you just buy a bunch of extra?
It came with four extra propellers, and mm-hmm. I've purchased eight extra propellers because I'm thinking I need propellers.
You're probably going to need them, yeah.
So this thing has been really nice. I've taken some aerial photos of some of the campuses now. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to come in from 1,000 feet down to the campus, and I'm going to fly by the building and fly right down to the front door as though I'm going into the front door, and that will be the beginning of a virtual tour.
I think that's a great idea.
So people wonder about that. So
let me ask you this. What happens if you lose power? I mean, it's a machine. Something could break, jam. What happens if you lose power to one of the rotors?
It'll just fall out of the sky. So they actually warn you. They say, whatever you do, do not turn off the motors. They said it will fall and be out of control.
So it
keeps track of the battery. When mm-hmm. when the battery gets to 30% point, the green lights, which indicate that we've got GPS, turn red on the flashing, and they turn flashing red lights on the unit, and then you know that you have to bring it down, and then the cell phone starts beeping. Mm-hmm. So then at 30%, you get a warning that you should start coming back. At 15%, the beep gets a little bit louder. Around 10%, it just lands. Mm-hmm. It just figures if you're ignoring me, we're just going
to
land.
Okay, so you've had this thing up to 1,050 feet, right?
Yeah.
And how far away from you horizontally?
Horizontally, I was around, when I lost range, I was around 300 or 400 feet horizontally.
So that's really as far as this thing will go.
Yeah,
it's not like you could send this thing over to the local pizza parlor.
No, because the RF transmitter has a range of about 1,500 feet.
How about this? If you were standing like on some sort of a platform, like mm-hmm. a fire tower or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So you're up above the tree line and you're mm-hmm. unobstructed. How far do you think you could get that thing to go away from you?
It's still 1,500 feet.
Still 1,500 feet.
I could go 15 out horizontally or
1,500.
The RF signal, you lose it at 1,500 feet. My Wi-Fi signal, I've got a Wi-Fi repeater. It goes out to 1,200 feet,
mm-hmm.
and the Wi-Fi is used for the video link between mm-hmm. my cell phone and the camera. So I actually can see. It's like first person video. As I'm flying it, it's like I'm sitting in the quadcopter flying it, because I can just sit there and fly it around.
It's amazing.
What I'm thinking of doing, when we fly it outside the WTOP offices, I'm going to look in the windows upstairs in WTOP and see how they're gathering the news.
Now, we are working on a little feature for next week. We're going to let you hear what it sounds like to operate this thing. And Doc is also going to post video, and we'll have still pictures of this thing. We'll have video of it, of the thing taken off.
That's
and we'll
right.
have video from the quadcopter
That's
while
right.
it's in the air.
And we'll fly over the construction site, then we'll fly over the police station next door, and we'll just see. We'll just see what happens.
Okay. We'll just see what happens. I don't like the sound of that. But we're going to post that all on techtalkonline.com after we run the feature next week. Doc, based on the time, why don't we just keep it here and you finish talking
about it? Okay, let's just do that.
Okay.
Okay, U.S. carriers can now block activation of stolen smartphones. See, this was actually a big problem in that, cell phones would get stolen, and the person could just reactivate them with the same carrier before, and the carriers, well, they didn't care because they had another account. So there was not really a big incentive for them to do anything, because they made more money if they just let the phones be reactivated. But finally, CTIA, which is the Wireless Industry Group, has announced that there is now a stolen phone database that all the carriers have agreed to use, AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint, and Verizon. And what they've done, too, they've integrated this database with the international carriers. So somebody could steal a phone in the U.S., and it's going to be blocked from activation internationally. Now, the good news is that that means that phones that are stolen are going to have much less value.
That's good.
Because you can't activate them, and so that may eliminate a lot of the phone theft problem, which is a huge problem. And organized crime's gotten involved with this. And what they do is they'll buy them in the U.S., they'll dump them overseas. This is what's been going on, especially with the GSM. So this finally came out. It's taken a long time for them to actually launch this, but it came out, and it's a quite a good feature, and I'm very glad they've done it. Mapping Happiness in America is using Twitter. In 2009, a group of University of Vermont researchers published a paper in the Journal of Happiness Studies. You ever read that one?
No, I've never read the Journal of Happiness Studies,
yeah. In it, they outlined a process of determining the saddest day in recent memory. And that was the day that Michael Jackson died. And that was
you got to be kidding me.
Well, that was based on data from blogs. So it was the saddest day since blogs had been started. Probably not the saddest day in history.
Ever.
Now, the happiest day they found, this was back in 2009, the happiest day they found in the time period that did it was the day that Obama was elected, November of 2008.
Okay.
Now, the paper's underlying concept dates back to 1881, when an Irish scientist conceived of the instrument called the hedonometer, hedonometer, which could measure the happiness of the population using the hedonometer.
This would be a dangerous thing to have.
It would be. Okay, so in 2009, this study does something different. It uses millions of words scraped from blogs and ranked according to happiness level. And in 2011, they refined the methodology and applied it to Twitter, by analyzing 46 million words. Now, the same researchers published a set of maps to show how their findings correlate to geographic locations, because Twitter is geo-targeted, so they could tell where the happy words were coming from. You see? And so
happy words.
And so they could tell how happy Americans are right down to the zip code where they're located.
Wow.
So as I said earlier, Hawaii in the study was the happiest state. Louisiana was the saddest. Napa was the happiest city. Because in Napa, residents were frequently tweeting about
wine
and restaurants.
There you go. I'll bet Colorado's pretty happy these
days. Okay, the saddest city was Beaumont, Texas.
Because it's about 1,000 degrees there, probably.
Who would have guessed?
Mm.
Okay, in general, cities in the south tended to be less happy than those in the north.
No kidding.
And if you look at the map, the cities in the west tended to be happier than the cities in the east. See, it's like a pinker is happier. See,
yeah.
If you look at the map there?
Yes.
So, so
Maine looks pretty happy. Go figure that.
Maine is quite happy.
But look at where Maryland is. Maryland.
Florida's happy. See Hawaii there's quite happy.
Yeah.
Florida's a little happier, but the... you can see the set. Kansas is kind of neutral in the middle.
They are. Alaska is neutral. But look, the unhappiest states, Louisiana, Alabama,
yep,
and Maryland. Look at that. The three that are in the darkest blue.
Yeah, Maryland's not happy with this study. Okay, and so they, using these, using all these words, they wrote this complex algorithm and analyzed 10 million tweets, geotagged them to give a happiness value. And I'll give a link to the site. This is a UVM site. It's actually just fun to look at the data.
Sure.
And every day they publish the happiest city and the saddest city on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a fun, different project that they have going on.
Sure.
So let's talk a bit about the sharing economy.
Mm-hmm.
The sharing economy has been quite interesting. Because there's been a trend where people are now sharing services. Now it started with a service called Airbnb. Have you ever heard of that? Airbnb.
I have not, no.
It's an online apartment lending service. That's one of the many services that have emerged in the sharing economy. What people realize is they can rent out their underused personal assets. So it happened that people might have an apartment that they're gone for the weekend, so they would rent it out for the weekend. And they're actually competing with hotels. And so they would go Airbnb, and they would rent out their apartment for the weekend, and they would pick up cash.
Not a bad idea.
So it was a way to pick up cash. It's not exactly new. eBay and Craigslist has it. People actually lend out their cars. They're gone. They lend out their cars. They can even lend out their spare time. And you get kind of ratings. People who are customers are rated, and so you can sort of check the credibility. So Airbnb really began expanding. In fact, New York sued people using Airbnb because they were missing out on the hotel taxing fees.
Ha!
You see?
Yeah.
So, but the sharing economy has allowed underemployed couples and families to actually pick up a little extra money, and it's sort of picked up as a result of this great, great recession. And so, there was a couple has a big house, a blended family. They had a lot of spare room when all the kids moved out. So they rented three or four of their rooms using Airbnb, and the room rate that they got paid their mortgage
mm-hmm.
when they were unemployed. So this has actually made a huge, huge deal. So there are all kinds of sharing devices that come, lending clubs. There are all kinds of things that have sort of developed in this sharing economy, and I think we're going to see more and more of it as people find a way to share safely and to share easily over the Internet. Well, it was a great show, and I loved bringing in the drone here in the
studio.
Yeah,
it was a lot of fun.
And so, listen, we're going to be running this thing. We're going to be running the drone next week. So we want you to check out techtalk@stratford.edu. We want your emails at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we also want you to check out the programs at Stratford by going to the Stratford website.
And if you missed any of the show or like to hear it again, it'll replay at 2 o'clock this afternoon.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
And we've got sports on the radio here on Federal News Radio later today. The Caps travel to Frozen Solid, Minnesota to take on the Wild. The pregame show starts at 7. The puck drops at 8 here on Federal News Radio. Sunny, maybe freezing today right outside our studios now. Clear skies. It is 20 at 10 a.m.
This commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated.